来嘛，不要死嘞，等你嘞，不要死嘞，等你嘞，来嘛来嘛，哎，来哎来哎来哎，不要死嘞，等你嘞，放下哎。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman, a fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today I'm joined by Marie Lal, a professor in Education and South Asian Studies at the University College London Institute of Education, to talk about Understanding Reform in Myanmar, People and Society in the Wake of Military Rule, published in 2016 by Hearst. Marie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Marie, these are exciting times for people in Myanmar and for anyone interested in the country as well. And your book really is positioned to explain how and why we've gone from unmediated and unapologetic military rule in the mid-2000s to a National League for Democracy government led de facto by Aung San Suu Kyi. You offer insights from over a decade of experience working in the country from the mid-2000s to the present. So could you begin by telling us a bit about what drew you to Myanmar or Burma and give us some sense of the professional and personal experiences you've had there that have contributed to the ideas and contents of the book?
Yes, it's really amazing to see the changes that have happened. The story actually starts in the year 2000. I was in Calcutta. I had a week on my hand, which nowadays never happens. And I was able to get a visa and get a direct flight from Calcutta to Yangon for a week. I'd never been to Myanmar before. I'd heard about it a lot because when I was growing up, my father had spent some time in what was then Burma in the 1970s as a WHO official. And so I was just curious, and I arrived in a country where there was virtually no streetlights and no cars, and it felt very backwards, so different from what I was used to from India and Pakistan, where I was working at the time. And a couple of years later, so I was intrigued and I wanted to go back and I wanted to work on the country, but obviously it was considered, it was under sanctions, it was considered not the kind of country you could just go in and do research. So I came across, through a colleague, I came across Bob Taylor, who was taking academics out to actually do work in Myanmar universities in 2000. He started this in 2004. And he was basically bringing people out with German Foundation money to engage with Myanmar colleagues and give them a way of engaging with research outside of their country. There was no internet for them. They didn't have access to journals, to books. And the idea was that the handful of academics, some from Singapore, me from London, a couple from Japan, would engage with them and do a summer training course so that they would be able to access what was going on in the outside world. And so when I came across this, I said, yes, I want to be part of this. And I went first for a conference. He asked me to first go for a conference and meet colleagues there. That way, the Myanmar Historical Commission had a conference in January 2005. And I landed in Yangon. And as we all know, in 2004, in the autumn of 2004, Kin Yunt, who was the head of military intelligence and who really had kept the screws on the development of civil society, no one could really do anything, say anything without being at risk of going to jail. He had been put under house arrest. So when I landed in January 2005, I met colleagues who said, well, there's military intelligence in disarray. You can actually pretty much go and do whatever you like for a few weeks anyway. And I was in the country just for a very short period, just for a week or 10 days. And I started meeting colleagues through universities, but also because I have an interest in schools, I started visiting schools and a budding private school network, which was started by someone who's now a friend of mine. And that is how I got engaged with the country. And then Bob Joyng Lang, who was co-organizing this training for academics, took me out in the summer of 2005. And then I went back again in the autumn of 2005 and I met Dr. Nguyen Mau, and that's where the story starts. So I started engaging with the founders of what became later on in 2006 Myanmar Egress at the end of 2005. And Dr. Nguyen Mau, who's really the protagonist of my story, was a medical doctor who'd gone away from medicine and who decided to be a journalist. And his belief was that he wanted change for the country. A lot of people wanted change, but that the change had to happen within what was possible inside. So pushing the boundaries, obviously with certain risks attached, but not in terms of revolution or not the way the NLD had been doing it. And he had spent a summer at Yale University, and that had sort of opened his eyes on political change. And so Nguyen Mao and I started collaborating, and I sort of tried to help where I could. And there were others, many others like me, who were part of this network as well, who started going in and started taking part and training our fellow Myanmar colleagues to sort of do adult education and access people who had not had the chance to go to universities because universities had been closed in the late 1980s and 1990s after the student protest movements. So the idea was social change from the inside, pushing change within what was possible, and it was possible because Kim Nguyen was gone, and it was also possible because there was a roadmap to quote-unquote democracy. And this roadmap was widely publicized. Everyone knew there would be a constitution which was imposed from above. Everyone knew this constitution would lead to an election which was going to be tightly controlled by the military. But it did mean that there was going to be some wiggle room to maneuver change. And within that wiggle room, that's what the founders of Myanmar Egress decided. They were going to try and push for as much as they could get. And, you know, that's where I came in, and a number of my colleagues came in as well.
As you've mentioned them a couple of times already, tell us a bit more about Myanmar Egress and how did they collaborate with other organizations and individuals around Myanmar to progress this project that you've just described?
So Myanmar Egress was a collaboration of a number of young men from very different backgrounds, all Burmese, who came together with a vision for change, but not necessarily with an agreed blueprint. So it was all of this started in the early 2000s with Nguyen Mao and De Montan driving around in a car and sort of discussing the state of affairs of the country. And the only place they could discuss this safely was in the car, because anywhere else they would have been eavesdropped upon. And bringing like-minded people together. And so Myanmar Egress evolved out of that little bit of space that was created in 2005, 2006. But it actually emulated, and I don't think Myanmar Egress founders would agree with me on this, but I think it emulated what we had seen civil society groups do in the ethnic areas after we had the first set of ceasefires in the 1990s and 2000s. So what had happened when Kim Nguyen had gone around agreeing gentlemen's agreements of ceasefires across the country, with the big exception of Karen, obviously the KNU never signed a ceasefire, never agreed a ceasefire. But he'd gone around from group to group to group, starting, you know, with the Mon and with the Kachin and with various Shan groups. And that had created, on the one side, it made everyone very rich because the Tatmadaw and the ethnic armed groups were able to sort of divide the economic spoils of the natural resources. But it, because no one was shooting anymore, it allowed for civil society to come in. And so we see the development of the Mehta Foundation, for example. We see development of Shalom, Nank Foundation. And so these are groups which then start going straight into areas where the state has failed, into education, for example, but also into livelihoods and sort of helping people build lives, supporting people building lives. And in many ways, Myanmar Egress wasn't different. It did exactly the same thing. As soon as that space opened up, they had that same vision of we need to educate people, we need to support people within a process of change. And collaboration is perhaps too strong a word, but Myanmar Egress was open to collaboration with pretty much anyone. In fact, it was at the time in sort of 2007, there were just a handful of civil society organizations, and all the leaders of these different civil society organizations, be it Janan Lato or be it Daw Seng Ro, all these people knew each other. They were all meeting and exchanging ideas. Myanmar Egress was part of this network. And perhaps it wasn't a collaboration. It was a, we are all working for the same goal, for change in the country. And we're doing it slowly and incrementally, pushing the boundaries so that we can actually bring about a bigger change. But in terms of sort of, you know, sort of alliances or collaborations, that rarely happens, Nick, as you very well know. Different organizations in Myanmar tend to not find it very easy to collaborate with each other. It's all very much based on a leader's vision. And so, you know, different organizations do things differently. What was great was that Myanmar Egress was able to communicate with all these different groups. The other thing which is perhaps important to understand is that Myanmar Egress, because it was the only Bama outlet which was able to do things like adult training, education, and so on and so forth, became the darling of international donors. So the FID and German foundations and the World Bank and God knows what, over the years, not instantly, it took a long time before the first funds started flowing. In fact, the first funds started sort of to come in 2007, 2008, and that's also linked to what happened with Nargis. But money started flowing because they were seen as the only organization that could get things done without being closed down by the regime. And so that made, obviously, that contributed to growth and contributed to expanded influence.
You were just flagging events in 2007 and 2008. And as we know, a lot has happened in Myanmar during the decade that your book covers. So for listeners who haven't followed the country closely, perhaps before we proceed, can you give us a short account of the most important moments in this period as you see them? And feel free to add any additional references to people and institutions that matter for our understanding of what's happened in Myanmar.
Well, 2007 was a really interesting time because we had what the press then dubbed the Saffron Revolution in September 2007, which was neither saffron nor was it really a revolution. But it was when all the monks came out on the streets and you had these fantastic photos of people on the streets protesting. So it was very much a watershed moment for Myanmar because it felt to many that you know, the society was coming out on the streets and was going protesting against this repressive regime. And actually, yes, there were protests, but actually they started as economic protests. So the world, it's really ironic, actually, because the World Bank had said, as they do for many years, that this high subsidy, that the state subsidies and fuel needed to stop. Not that the World Bank was particularly active in Myanmar, it wasn't there, but it was one of those messages, international messages, that the regime was, you know, that was one of the things the regime was doing wrong. Well, someone in the regime at some point decided, oh, yes, well, we'll get rid of the subsidies overnight. And it wasn't the first time that this had happened. But when it did happen, then people suddenly couldn't pay for their bus ticket to get to work because overnight, suddenly everything became unbelievably expensive. And so that brought people on the out on the streets, and it brought the monks out on the streets as well, because monks are immediately affected economically. When people can't pay for their, you know, their bus fares and their food, monks also receive fewer donations, and the whole sort of thing spirals into the Sangha as well. So this is how the protest started. But the protest did take on a political turn. And within a few days, we were hearing cries for democracy. And I was actually in the country when this was happening. And I was sitting with friends and we were all saying, when is the military going to come out and shoot? Which they in the end actually did do. They did come out and shoot. And everyone said, oh, we're going backwards. And this is, you know, there's going to be, we're going back to where we were in 1988. And all that little bit of incremental movement and reform that we had is all finished. And actually, it wasn't. Yes, it was awful with regard to all those people who were arrested. I mean, the Myanmar regime, the Takmador and the military intelligence were out. They were out and where they were photographing people. And then they came to their houses at night and arrested them. And people were given 100 plus year sentences. I mean, it was ridiculous and draconian. But with all that said and done, ultimately speaking, within about a month or two, apart from those who went to jail, life within the civil society network, not only Myanmar Egress, but everyone else, including Shalom and so on and so forth, were back to normal. They, you know, they didn't shut down. The trainings continued. The work that people were doing were continued. There wasn't a crackdown on those organizations that had been operating in Yangon and in mainly Yangon, but also in some of the ethnic area, which is really interesting because it almost felt to us at that time that there might be a shift in the thinking at military level. So if you challenge the regime head on, you risk detention and, well, you get put away, trial and detention. But if you work and they don't perceive you as a threat, then you are able to do quite a lot. And that was, you know, actually what that meant is that suddenly Myanmar Egress, and I cannot speak for other organizations, but I know that with regard to Myanmar Egress, that they said, okay, this is clearly the way forward. And one of the things they started doing is encouraging young people to document things. So not go and protest, but document what they saw and use that sort of almost photojournalistic approach to get people involved. So document what you see, write about it, speak about it, but don't go out and stand as a protester, because you'll achieve more that way. And that was a really interesting approach. That's 2007. And then 2008, so May 2008, two things happened. One is this constitution, which has been written by the military regime and imposed. So, you know, the National Convention had theoretically engaged with civil society and other and ethnic groups and so on, but actually no one's opinions were taken on board. This was just a document which was written by the regime and imposed on the people. So that was going to be put down to a referendum. And at the same time in May, we have Cyclone Nargis, which strikes. And Cyclone Nargis is obviously a tragedy because it, I don't have the figures in my head anymore, but it kills, I think it's over 100,000 people. In the Delta, and it destroys the Delta entirely economically, and Yangon is severely affected, the whole of the South is affected, and, you know, the military is sitting in Naypyidaw, and first few days, nothing happens at all, and, you know, people are, I have accounts, I wasn't in the country at the time, I have accounts from people of how, you know, the food prices went up, and obviously, you know, all these, the dead bodies were there in the Delta, and it was all terrible. But what came out of this was really interesting. So Timon Thanos told me that he walked across to the Tanada Hotel, which is where the headquarters of Myanmar Egress were. And as the day, this is the day after Nargis is struck, so when everyone's woken up with all the broken trees in their front yard, as the day went on, the students who had studied at Myanmar Egress, the alumni, all started to come and gather, saying, what is it that we can do? And this is not only with Myanmar Egress, this was also the case with other civil society organizations. People started to gather around civil society leaders and say, we want to do something, but clearly the authorities are not, you know, they're not going into the Delta, they're not distributing food, they're not distributing blankets, they're not distributing water. And this is how you suddenly find that civil society is taking on the burden of what the state is supposed to do and starts going out into the Delta to deliver water, food, blankets. And because the regime insists that international aid agencies are not allowed to go out there, I mean, they did actually allow for Asian aid agencies and Asian doctors. So we had Bangladeshi doctors and Thai doctors and Indian doctors. They were all allowed into the Delta. It's just the Western aid agencies weren't allowed direct access. The Western aid agencies start to fund different civil society organizations. So everything from just a small student movement which pops up on the day, right up to Myanmar Egress, which is a big organization by this point, is funded to go out and deliver aid in the Delta. And what this does is it strengthens the civil society movement and those different organizations in a way that nothing else could have. The funds just kept flowing. People were able to go out there, get training, get employment. And for months, you find that these different organizations start collaborating with each other, delivering aid. And it changes the possibilities of what civil society can do in the country. It also obviously allows Western aid agencies to start re-engaging with the country because they hadn't given the sanctions regime. And you suddenly find this influx of aid agencies into Yangon. And you know, the downside of that is that all the rents go up and prices go up and the fabric of how Yangon functions changes quite dramatically. I'll give you an example. I've normally stayed with a close friend of mine she's a foreigner, but she's lived in Yangon for over 20 years, and she's a child psychologist. Overnight, her rent doubled, and her car that she was renting was taken away because the owner of the car and the owner of the house basically found that they could rent out the car and the house to, you know, sort of UNICEF or World Bank officials for sort of twice and three times, and then later on five times the price. So yes, this had negative effects as well. But broadly, Cyclone Nargis allowed a collaboration between international aid agencies and Myanmar civil society, which would not have been possible otherwise. And just the fantastic thing is that those civil society organizations, which then suddenly multiplied in that period, they remain active even beyond the crisis. And that's what really changes things.
Perhaps two other years that deserve mention briefly before we continue are the 2010 with the elections and 2012 with the by-election.
Well, 2010. So, well, first we have constitution, which has been put to a referendum at the same time that we have Cyclone Nargis. So in the Delta and in the Yangon, the referendum is postponed. The referendum comes through with ridiculously high approval numbers in the sort of, I don't know, I can't remember if it was 98% or 99%, something absolutely. We all know that those were fake results. But in fact, that was one thing I didn't say earlier on. There was a movement across Yangon's youth. I suspect it was not so much across the rest of the country, but mainly Yangon and perhaps Mandalay, where people were saying we have to reject this constitution. But in the end, obviously, that movement was, even if people would have rejected the constitution, the military did come in and stuff the ballot boxes. And there was this massive approval of the constitution. But what's important there is that the constitution sets the way forward for an election. And now that we have the constitution in place and we know that there's going to be an election, which means that the trio at the top, Tan Shui and company, are going to go. There is going to be a more participatory system, provided that the Myanmar civil society organizations can get their act together and put people in place that are going to be able to take part in these elections. So between 2008 and 2010, a huge amount of work starts. And what happens is, well, first of all, the realization is we don't have any political parties, because the NLD clearly says with this illegal constitution, a constitution that was not approved by the people, we don't want anything to do with this. We were against the constitution, we're against these elections, we want the 1990s election recognized. Those who disagree with that, the other side, are the people who say, we can't wait for 1990 to be recognized. We have waited 18 years, 19 years. It's going to be 20 years. We need to move forward. We need to find an alternative way through this quagmire. And one of the ways to do this is to start getting involved politically, because politics becomes legal again overnight. You know, effectively, if you're going to have an election, you're going to have political parties. And one of the things which happened was that to look at political opposition in an ethnic way, because the NLD wasn't going to stand, and the USDA, which was the regime's association for all the employees of the state, becomes the USDP, which is the main regime party. And so they have all the money that they want, that they need to sort of have an MP standing in each and every constituency. So how do you stand against such a state machine? And this is where you see the collaboration between Myanmar Egress and other civil society organizations, specifically ethnic civil society organizations. Myanmar Egress reaches out to different ethnic civil society organizations saying we need ethnic parties to be created, And the story goes, I wasn't there at the time, but the story goes, and I heard it from Nguyen Mao and I heard it from a number of other people, is that the different civil society leaders from ethnic organizations, be it from Cultural Literature Society or civil society leaders, ethnic leaders, were invited to come to Yangon, sit in a room together, and literally pushed to create political parties so that there would be Chin parties, Rakhine parties, Mon parties, or at least one that would be able to stand. And part of that process also involves getting funding for these new parties because it's, no one has any money. And so it is, again, Myanmar Egress takes on the job to try and get, and partly this is through aid money, but partly this is also through business networks where businessmen are encouraged to donate to the political cause so as to create a limited plural system where there is some form of political choice. In parallel, obviously, we have the split of the NLD. And I think that that's something that Tan Shui, Senior General Tan Shui, had sort of wanted, and he had hoped that that would kill off the NLD. So by saying we're going to have the elections in 2010, understanding very much that Aung San Suu Kyi would be against her party standing for the 2010 elections, but that within her party there would be some who would want to stand, and that's how we see the creation of the NDF, the National Democratic Force. And I think the regime's aim at that point was to sort of hope that that would kill off the NLD. That's obviously not what happened at all. So the NDF stands, they are in many ways a very small, limited opposition. And then you have these small ethnic parties, which don't do too badly in 2010 within their own constituencies, given the fact, given this mammoth USDP party they're standing against. I mean, in many constituencies, in fact, there was just the USDP standing, and in some cases the NUP, which was the old Socialist Party, because there was just no one else that could stand because the NDF didn't have the money or the people to put one person to every constituency. And if it's a Bamaan majority area, there wouldn't have been an ethnic party. So we end up in 2010 with an election result where many people feel cheated because having this massive party, which is available to the military, the ballot boxes are stuffed in some of the, not in all, but in some of the constituencies. So with advanced votes, so this is something which is, let me just go back a little bit. In Myanmar, the voting took place at two times. So there were the advanced votes for the military and for those people who were working for the Tatmadaw and for the regime. And then there was a ballot on the day, which means that in quite a number of constituencies where certain opposition members might have thought that they would have won, given the count of the day, given the turnout of the day, once the advanced votes came in, which obviously had been tampered with, those seats were lost. So there was a great deal of disappointment and disillusionment across many of these civil society organizations that had worked towards trying to make this election perhaps not fair, and certainly not free because that was not within their gift, but allow for alternative candidates to those of the regime to be elected in some places. There was a lot of disillusionment. But in hindsight, when we step back and we look at early 2011, the results are not great, but you do have a number of non-regime people for the first time in power at a regional level and at a national level. So you have non-regime MPs, and that suddenly you have different voices that become part of the system. So again, whilst it felt at the time like a number of steps back, it ended up still taking the process forward. You need the hindsight to be able to understand that. At the time, we all felt that we'd been cheated, that even with this mammoth party of the USDP, the regime had on top of it done the ballot box stuffing and therefore had robbed people of a voice, of a legitimate voice. And there was a lot of disillusionment. But actually, in hindsight, those ethnic party MPs that got elected And those NDF MPs that got elected were able to do quite a lot of work, surprising amounts of work, in fact. Sorry, are we talking 2010? I forgot 2012. Want me to go on to 2012?
Perhaps briefly, yes.
So 2010, we have the elections. We have the USDP majority government comes into play. Tan Shui had already decided who was going to be president, who was going to be Speaker of the House. He had finally balanced all the voices in what was going to be this new government so that you would have what he believed an ineffective president, a strong speaker, but very conservative first vice president who was going to keep everyone in check. And so when you look at the results in early 2011, when the people start taking their seats, you realize whilst it is more pluralistic and more participatory, there is the way that the power has been distributed makes it very difficult to change very much. And so it comes as a surprise to everyone that in August 2011, when the government, we haven't heard anything out of NAPIDOR since Xinjiang, more or less, so since April 2011, nothing has really happened. The parliament was dubbed the 15-minute parliament because they just had sessions where people showed up, were asked a question, there was a quick vote, and then people went home. So it was really, it looked very much like a puppet parliament. And then suddenly things started to change quite dramatically. So what had happened between sort of March 2011 and August 2011, my understanding is that sort of more hardline conservative military representatives versus more reformists had sort of battled it out. And the president, Thein Sein, when he started to come to power, the first thing he did is started to address the people, which was something quite new. So he started to give these speeches over the radio saying, this is what I'm going to do. And then he went away and got it done. And they actually continued this right through the 5 years. But in August 2011, so Aung San Suu Kyi has been let out of house arrest. House arrest period has ended. She's gone off, and the NLD is theoretically, it's not no longer a legal political party because they didn't stand for the elections in 2010. So actually they're an outlawed organization. And in August 2011, we find the president invites Aung San Suu Kyi to NAPIDOR. And we all wake up in the morning to a picture in the new light of Myanmar with the president, Aung San Suu Kyi, both standing under her father's portrait. And this is the first sign that this president is extremely serious about taking forward a reform process. At this point, no one knows how wide this reform process is going to go, but he had spoken in a speech about national reconciliation, and he had followed up by inviting Aung San Suu Kyi to NAPIDOR and starting a negotiation process. And this negotiation process allows the NLD to come back into the political fold, and the NLD agrees to stand for the 2012 elections, and Aung San Suu Kyi, as we all know them, became an MP and joined the government. Now, in many ways, this was a huge success for Thein Sein, because he had re-included what was Myanmar's national hero or heroine in the political process, and in a collaborative way by bringing her into the government through the 2012 elections. And that then set the tone for the reform process, which starts after that.
Thanks for that great synopsis of key events and personages. And another topic that you dedicate a lengthy chapter to in the book is the peace process, with armed groups that still in one form or another are operating autonomously in the country's frontier regions, such as the Chinese and Thai borders. Can you give us some sense of what's been going on with the peace process that's different today from in the past? And why does this process matter so much for prospects of lasting political change in Myanmar?
So Myanmar started its life, or Burma in those days, as an independent country with in conflict, with lots of conflicts. So the Second World War really never stopped in many ways. So when 1945, 46, you have the Japanese and then the British, and actually the Japanese and the British wars on Burmese soil politicize and arm different ethnic groups and sort of split off people. So a very big overgeneralization would be that ethnic groups were in support of the British and many of the the Bama population was in support of the Japanese, and that sort of splits the country. And at the time of independence in 1948, you have various wars going on, partly also fueled by the Burmese Communist Party, which is getting support from China. And you've got the Karen War, which actually was the longest war in Asia until it stopped in 2012. So the country is at war and continues to be at war right through the 1950s and 1960s. And so we have three peace processes or three elements of this big sort of peace thing. And I can't really spend too much time on the first one, but effectively you have that big movement towards these inofficial, non-written, non-signed peace agreements under Kim Yunt in the 1990s, which I spoke about briefly earlier on, which include pretty much everyone apart from the KNU. Obviously, there are some other groups which continue fighting as well, but the KNU is a sort of big one which continues fighting. But everyone else sort of broadly stops fighting, and this is this is not a political peace process. This is an economic peace process. This is about trying to exploit the economic riches of the ethnic borderlands. And let's call it the ceasefires that are in place, they don't last. There's always skirmishes here, there, and everywhere, but also with regard to the constitution and the government or the regime wanting those groups to join the border guard force mean that there's tremendous instability and also tremendous repression, which continues. What changes in 2011, 2012 is the president, Thein Sein, goes and says, right, in order for us to be able to take this country to the next step forward, in order to be able to actually have a reform process, we need to have a peace process. So it's not only about national reconciliation, it's also about peace. So President Thein Sein had four priorities. The first one was national reconciliation with the NLD. And he said that on the radio. I mean, I'm actually just quoting what he said. The second one was peace process with the ethnic armed groups. The third one was economic development and economic reform. And the fourth one, which came a bit later in one of the later speeches, was education reform, because he saw that as underpinning economic reform and underpinning societal change. So the peace process becomes incredibly important. And actually, at the start of it, Thein Sein is quite a hardliner, because in 2011, aside from the fact that we have Aung San Suu Kyi going to Naypyidaw, we also have a resumption of war in Kachin State. So a ceasefire that had lasted since the 1990s breaks down, and it's not about who started shooting first, but basically the war in Kachin State resumes, and the military goes in, guns blazing. It's really horrendous, with helicopter gunships and all the rest of it, and right up to the KIA strongholds of Liza and Majayang. So it's really a proper war. This is not a small skirmish. At this point, President Thein Sein is a hardliner, and he wants the KIA to surrender. And then there is, over the next few months, a change of heart or mind. And I don't know where this came from, but in early 2012, we start to see a change of rhetoric coming out of the president's office with regard to conflict and peace. And one of the things that the president had started, he had started sending different envoys to different groups to start talking about a lasting ceasefire, a peace process. And this develops into what became the peace process, where the biggest change of the government is to say to the armed groups, you can negotiate together. Prior to this, all negotiations were always the regime or the Tatnador with one group or the other group, the divide and rule thing. Here, President Thein Sein accepts and agrees that the different ethnic armed groups can meet together, including on Burmese soil, on Myanmar soil, negotiate a common position and come back. And this is something which is unprecedented. And whilst the nationwide ceasefire agreement, which was signed in October 2015, basically did not include all the groups. We only had eight out of the, you know, it was a dispute if it's 16 groups or 18 groups or 20 groups, depending on who is in and who is out of the count. Despite the fact that this is seen by many as a failure because it's only eight groups to be signed, I don't see this as a failure. I see this as a huge success in terms of the first step towards peace. Because what it allowed for all the different ethnic groups to come together and to negotiate face-to-face with the Tatmadaw and agree one text. The text of the ceasefire agreement was agreed by all. Where they all fell apart was who was allowed to sign, who was allowed to take part. And you know, that's a longer story about resumption of fighting in Shan State and in Rakhine State and in other places and new groups emerging. So I don't want to go there. But what I want to bring out of this is how the mindset of the government changed, allowing the ethnic groups to work together. And this is what has laid the path for today's peace process. So Aung San Suu Kyi has come in and said, we're going to have a new Panglong conference. We're going to have a 21st century Panglong conference, which is going to happen at the end of August. And my understanding is that she's been conciliatory and said we will have all groups, signatories and non-signatories, represented at these negotiations. But in order to get to this point, we had to go through this realization by the Tatmadaw that it was okay to negotiate with all groups together at one table. And that's really the big thing that Thein Sein was able to achieve during his tenure.
In contrast to the generally optimistic mood on the peace process that you've just described, the last substantive chapter of the book addresses a topic that many people think has marred the otherwise mostly good news story of Myanmar's political change in the last few years, namely the rise of Buddhist nationalism and correspondingly outbreaks of anti-Muslim violence. Can you please briefly describe the phenomena with which this chapter is concerned, and what's your reading of those phenomena?
So the rise of Buddhist nationalism is a rise in many ways, and I'm not the expert on Buddhist nationalism. There are many others who are, but it is a rise of a more radical right-wing movement, which is supported by the monkhood, the Sangha. Let me say a couple of words to that. First of all, anti-Muslim feeling, anti-Islamic feelings in Myanmar are not new. Every 10 odd years or so, very similar to what we see in India, there are anti-Muslim movements which gather pace around a rape or a murder or an alleged rape or an alleged murder or something, and people go out and start fighting, and there are, you know, and killing and looting and burning. So this is nothing new. In a small sense, it's nothing new because we've seen this before. But till very recently, there weren't any cameras on the ground, and this was not something that the regime tolerated. So normally the regime came in, you know, the police and the army came in very quickly and shut down any of these riots, and the outside world never got to hear about them. What is new from a Western perspective, I tend to find that people tend to think of the monk at the Sangha as good and the military as bad. And I think why people's imagination has been sort of sparked by this is because suddenly monks happen to be anti-Muslim and rioting and part of mobs that are taking mosques apart. I mean, at the moment, we've just had one mosque in Kachin State and one mosque in Bagul, which both have been destroyed just, you know, in the last couple of weeks. So people on the outside are a bit shocked by this. Actually, it's not that surprising because any society which goes through major economic and societal change, you saw this in India, for example, as well, tends to have let's go back to the roots kind of imagination, kind of idea that comes up. And in many ways, the Sangha has come up, embodiment, it's the embodiment of who are we? Who are the Bamar? Who are the Burmese? What defines our national identity? And our national identity is Buddhist. And anyone who's really not, you know, not a Buddhist, can they be part of this? Can they not be part of this? I did a major piece of field work a few years ago where I was asking young people about citizenship and asking them what their citizenship, how they define citizenship. How do you define being a Burmese citizen, a Myanmar citizen? And in large amounts of cases, 2/3 of the answers, being Buddhist was part of it. What was also particularly interesting, so we're talking about 2,000 young people here across the country, including in ethnic areas. What was also interesting was how the right to live in this country was seen as, Myanmar people didn't have any rights, you know, under the military regime. But the right to live in the country is linked to religion and ethnic identity, the Burmese Buddhist ethnic and religious identity. Which I think is where we can then go and look at what's happening in Northern Rakhine State, where there's obviously a Muslim community, which is not wanted in Bangladesh and it's not wanted in Myanmar. And it's an incredibly sad humanitarian story, how these people have been treated and how they've ended up in camps. But it goes back to this identification with Burma Buddhism as the requirement to be a Myanmar citizen and to be allowed to live in the country. And this is what young people, old people, everyone in the heartland believes. And so this in itself feeds into the Sangha movement, which then supports this this kind of identification. And obviously this is what has shocked everyone, because Aung San Suu Kyi hasn't said anything with regard to the Muslim populations of Rakhine State, the Rohingya, for example, because there are more Muslim groups than just the Rohingya. Let's be absolutely clear. The Rohingya are one group, and then there are other Muslim groups across the country as well. And the reason that Aung San Suu Kyi hasn't said anything about the maltreatment of this community and about the Muslims in general is because she sees the support for her and for the NLD coming from the Buddhist community. And if she were to stand up for the Muslim minorities, she would be seen as a traitor. And it is quite that stark, you have to put it this way. Whilst this doesn't make anything okay, I hope this is sort of a basic explanation as to what is going on and why suddenly what was seen as the peaceful movement, the monks being a peaceful movement trying to change society, has actually turned out to be a right-wing Buddhist nationalist movement, which to many people seems to be a contradiction in terms.
You mentioned the field work that you did on citizenship, and as I recall, that work was done as part of a larger project on citizenship education and civic education. You've taught and researched education for many years and have an intimate knowledge of educational reforms in Myanmar. You also have a chapter in the book on that topic, and it'd be remiss, I think, not to discuss it briefly before we close. So would you like to tell us something about how schooling and higher education in Myanmar have changed over the last decade and what your hopes and expectations are for this field in the future?
Education has been really at the bedrock of my work, but I've been very fortunate that I was able to train a small research team whilst I was out in Myanmar with some as part of the EU project, and they're the ones who actually went out and gathered a lot of the data. But whilst I've done a lot of traveling, a lot of data gathering, I wouldn't have been able to go to all the places to get data, and my little team did that. But so that's just as a by of where all this data has come from. I've done all of my data collection in the field for all these chapters, and all of it's based on original data. With regard to education, this is where the story started. As I mentioned in answer to your first question, I was able to go and visit some of the nascent private schools in 2005, January 2005, where you really just had a handful of small private schools which had come in first as supplementary schools, and then later on this became a big movement for private education in the country, which was originally actually illegal because all children are supposed to go to government school. And education changed dramatically because middle-class parents, so as Myanmar was becoming richer, middle-class parents, so in nascent middle class, wanted to see their children educated better than what the government system could provide. So they were the ones who were willing to invest in a private school system. They were also the ones who were setting up private school networks. And at the when suddenly senior regime officials started sending their children to private schools, that's when the legality of these private schools changed. This means that this has dramatically changed the schooling landscape, because you have a two-tier system, as in most of South Asia. In fact, Myanmar is following India and Pakistan and other countries where you know, the middle classes are sending their children to private school, and then the government system is really only for the poor. So quite a revolution on an education scale, but it has also meant that this underpins the societal changes that we see. Without this network of private schools, with the middle classes able to send their children to these private schools, we wouldn't see the embedding of any of these changes, because the state would just be controlling the narrative through the schooling and through textbooks. And so they don't control it anymore, because there are alternatives. So in many ways, education is at the origin of, so Myanmar Egress saw the opportunity of using adult education to change people's perception of what was possible and what was not possible. And middle-class parents followed suit by sending their children to middle-class schools. And so we have a change of middle-class society, and they are really the agents of change. And arguably, a lot of the reforms we're talking about affect mainly the middle classes. And we haven't spoken about what happens in the rural areas and the poor areas and the dry zone and in the center of the country, where these changes are, whilst Myanmar is opening up and changing economically, the societal changes haven't yet sickened through, because we don't have change as an education system. But this is hopefully going to change as well, because the last government, as I said, Thein Sein's fourth priority was education reform. And this government says that it sees education as an important place where to embed the reform process, to start changing society. I would argue that within the first 100 days of the NLD government, we haven't really seen very much change at government education level. But there are small things which are changing. So, for example, I'm doing a current project with the British Council looking at who's becoming a teacher and what's happening in the teacher training colleges. And we find that obviously now there is access to the teacher training colleges. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years ago, there was no access to these teacher training colleges. And now teacher trainees are being exposed to new teaching methodologies and to more English. And so we're talking about, again, incremental change, but most things in Myanmar start at a very incremental level. And so this latest project about who's becoming a teacher and why and what is happening at teacher training level is incredibly interesting, because that's what I'm sort of working on at the moment. And hopefully there will be within these four, my hopes for the country are that within these next 4 or 5 years, we will see a radical reform of the curriculum, of the way teaching happens, a lifting up of the teaching profession, because at the moment teachers earn very little, next to nothing. And so in order to get good people to teach, like a Teach for Myanmar kind of program, you would have to actually make the teaching profession respectable and well paid again. So that would change society across the country, not just the middle classes and the urban areas, which is where the reform process till now has really stopped.
Well, you referred to your hopes and expectations for the education system, as I asked. And in a sense, the book really is a forward-looking book. There's a great deal in it, of course, that we haven't covered, and I do urge listeners to take a look at it for themselves. But the book, in any event, ends with the 2015 elections and anticipates further reforms in its contents. The country is confronted with a huge number of, at times, seemingly overwhelmingly challenges, but it's clear that you, like so many other people, are optimistic about its prospects. Are there one or two other features of the current situation and looking ahead among these challenges, one or two that you'd like to mention before we close?
Yes, I think the most important thing I'd like to mention is that the reforms and the changes, as we have seen over the last decade, are driven and embedded by civil society. And I'm afraid that this current government And we have that when we've had 100 days of this current government, but this current government doesn't seem to be that keen on civil society involvement in the same way that the previous government was, or that, prior to that, obviously, Tan Shui and regime didn't actually support civil society involvement, but civil society involvement happened. So I think the country will benefit most and will progress most if there is a collaboration between government and different civil society entities and actors. If there is, again, a sort of separation between the two, civil society is left to pick up the pieces that the state is not providing in health and education and so on, but that they're not part of the policy-making process, then I think the country's reform process will stall or will at least slow down. It's the collaborative aspect which I want to emphasize, and I do hope that the NLD will learn to see the value of collaborating with all these different civil society organizations. And there are thousands of them now, and it's a whole rainbow of activities which is happening. But it's the collaborative aspect which will take the country forward. It's not going to happen top down with the government just leading and leaving out civil society. It has to be collaborative.
That's a very interesting observation, and I hope that the message is heard. And what about for yourself? You've mentioned one ongoing project that you have. What can you say a bit more about what you're working on now and what we can expect to hear and read from you next?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on, this British Council project, which I said, which is about teacher trainees and what's happening in teacher education colleges. But I've just been commissioned to write a piece on a diversity in education systems. So whilst my entire life's work with regard to education has always said that it's important that the state is involved in education, and I'm the kind of person who, especially in India and Pakistan, has always argued against the privatization of education, low-fee private schools, and so on and so forth. For Myanmar, I take a slightly different view. I'm writing this current project on allowing as diverse an education system as possible. And the reason I'm doing this is because the centralization tendency that we've just seen with the NLD with regard to, not that keen on collaborating with civil society, but also sort of wanting to control what happens in schools doesn't really allow for this wide variety of different ethnic education systems that we have in the country. We didn't speak about that at all. I mean, a lot of my work's been on mother tongue-based education, how schools in ethnic areas use mother tongue in order to be able to get children into schools, and how that actually changes the dynamics, because the poorest children of the ethnic areas are then able to actually learn. If you research shows, and this is Burmese research, this is research by Shalom, shows that children in ethnic areas who go to a government school and have to learn in Burmese, they can't follow what the teacher says, and so there they drop out. So a lot of the ethnic education systems that have been set up in Mon and in Karen and in Kachin State, for example, actually allow children to learn in their mother tongue. And I find that it's important to have this diversity of education systems and to let this grow a little bit organically as opposed to trying to control it, which is what we see now. So that's what I'm writing on and working on at the moment, to try and sort of lobby the government in many ways to see that those successful systems in the ethnic area should be supported and integrated, and as opposed to sort of stamped out or perhaps marginalized, which is what I have the feeling is might happen unless there is a groundswell of support.
Well, Marie Lau, that I wish you all the best for those projects, and also thank you a lot for this tremendously informative discussion, for speaking with me today about understanding reform in Myanmar, people and society in the wake of military rule.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everybody for listening. I do hope you'll join me again for another meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asia Studies. Hey, like I see you at the tender boat. Monkey! Hey, like I see you at the tender boat. Monkey!